And I would also want to introduce his wife, Leslie, and I'd ask her to please stand now, and let's give her a warm welcome. Our speaker today, George, and I have to stop and look at it in black and white because I usually mess it up the way it's spelled. George Jurgowski, he's department chair for astronomy at Caltech. And by the way, Caltech probably has more Nobel Peace Prize awards than about any other university in the country, I'm told. George was born in Yugoslavia. And he was able to get out in 1979 before some country over there moved in. And he went to the West Coast, believe it or not, and he's still at the West Coast. But seriously, he, 1979, all right, as we move forward, he gets a PhD from UC Berkeley, then to a prestigious doctoral fellowship from Harvard and a Harvard Junior Fellow prior to joining Caltech faculty in 1987. This man is co-author of more than 600 scientific papers, more than 600, think of that, and he's considered to be one of the top 1,000 in the world in his specialty. Think of that, top 1,000 in the world. Co-author of 600 scientific papers. He co-chairs the Keck Observatory Science Steering Committee, Keck 10-meter optical infrared telescopes on the Big Island of Hawaii, because it was built there because they tried to find out where you get more clear nights year-round than any other location in the world. And that's the reason it's on the Big Island of Hawaii. He has an asteroid named after him, Jurgowski, as well as a global star cluster, Jurgowski 1. Another astronaut that he discovered, he had named after some close friends, and you may remember one of them as a speaker here, Mike Yanni and his wife, Gail. It was very kind of George to do that. George's wife, Leslie Maxfield, a native of Houston. You've seen that city's name in the TV and everywhere for a long time yesterday and the day before. Her BA and MA are both in astronomy, and she has been at Caltech herself since 1999. And what she covers in her area prepares all the digital information for help for the faculty and the administration. And you may have seen some of her work on some of the TV programs. I normally don't do this, but I asked George for some biographical information. Now, if you want me to read it word for word, I will, but then we won't have time for George. But there's a couple key things here I do want to mention. He's been exploring the scientific and educational uses of virtual reality since 2008, in quotes, before it was fashionable. He's also co-founder, and this is very important, and I think that he will comment on this organization, but it's amazing what has been accomplished this far. Name of the company is Virtual Reality Office of Virtualytics. I asked him to spell that out and pronounce it last night about five times, so I did the best I could do, George. I'm sorry. He also has an asteroid named himself, number 24421, as well as a global star cluster. Guess what the name is? Jurgowski 1. That is very difficult to obtain, that kind of recognition. I could go on with, I've only covered about the first paragraph of what he gave me, but I would like to pass and give more time to our speaker today, George Jurgowski.
Thank you so much, Dave, for this very kind introduction. It's a pleasure and honor to be here and talk to you. If I can have my slides on, please. Oh. Something happened here. I did hear a beep. Sorry. I thought, what did you do with my laptop? Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
You have a light.
Good. Thank you. Well, I work at an Institute of Technology, so. As they've said, I'm a professor and chair of astronomy at Caltech, and also founder and director of Center for Data-Driven Discovery, which is data science outfit at Caltech, and that's mostly what I'll be talking about, as well as a co-founder and chief virtual reality officer of a company called Virtualytics. And as I sometimes say, like many poor people, I have to work three jobs to make the ends meet. So what I'll be talking about today is how are some technologies changing our world, science as well as everything else. And this is a very special time. We never in history had a technology that's evolving as fast as information technology. It follows Moore's law, doubling in capabilities every year and a half or so. And nothing in the past has been changing things. Just think what the world was like before the World Wide Web, and that's only a couple decades. Well, now people talk about big data, and the data are big because they're produced with the same technology that follows Moore's law. And it increases, and it really is changing everything in science, scholarship, but also industry, commerce, business. But people are really misfocusing on the fact that data are big. The real reason why we have these data is to discover some actionable knowledge in the data. And that's not so easy to do. So how much data is there in the world? Well, this is actual graph. This is an exponential curve increasing exponentially. And these numbers are really hard to get, and they're approximate. But today, roughly speaking, there is about 50 zettabytes of information, of digital information in the world. And I'm showing there, it's 50 billion terabytes. And terabytes are pretty big already. You know, 50 million gigabytes. And a gigabyte is more than one human genome. And gigabyte is also 1,000 megabytes. And a megabyte is roughly what the book is, just in text. So that's a lot of data. And sometimes people ask me, what's really new? Why is this not just same old stuff, same old science, but with more data? And I can think of three things. The first one is that for the first time in history, we cannot see all of our data. The human bandwidth is maybe roughly a terabyte a year. And so we cannot look at all of our data. So we have to have technologies that can store, access, tell us where the data are, and so on. And then, it's not just the data are big, but the data are complex and better and have more information content than ever before, which enables profitable data mining, which is what really knowledge extraction is all about. So this is where we need machine intelligence or data, machine learning. And finally, and this is what I find is most interesting, is that we're pretty sure that in these exponentially growing masses of data, there are meaningful structures, correlations, clusters, anomalies. They're so complex that they exceed cognitive capacity of a human mind unaided. And this is why we need artificial intelligence to help us discover things in these data that otherwise we'll never be able to do. So just to give you a schematic outline what this might look like, and here is my cartoon of three-dimensional cube, but think of it as not three-dimensional, but 300-dimensional cube, or 3,000-dimensional cube, and in it there's a bunch of data. You measure hundreds or thousands of numbers for every single one of what you're studying. Say, humans. Imagine that there is a pharma company, and they're studying new cancer drug, and they have lots of patients, and they have all clinical data for them, all demographic data, environmental data, all the genetic data, and there could be literally 1,000 different items for each person they study. And so they try some drug and finds out that only effective maybe 0.1% cases, so they will not do anything about it. But in some corner of this huge data space, there is something special. It's 100% effective. So for a particular group of people, it is a miracle drug. And so this is where precision medicine is going today, that they're going to really individualize treatments. And in order to do this, they'll have to process vast quantities of data. And I can tell you the medical community is absolutely, totally unprepared for this. And this is why they need tools that I'll be describing. So, again, the real challenge here is not the data are big, but the data are complex. They can have many different quantities describing any one of whatever you're studying, whether it's stars, whether it's humans, whether it's cars or stock market portfolios. There is a whole bunch of things that each one of those has. And each of those essentially is a dimension of a data space. And those dimensions can be numerous. So there can be interactions between different variables. You can imagine anything to do, well, say with stock market or climate or anything like this. It's not just one thing that drives it. That could be many of them interacting in a complex way. And so how can you see this? This is what I think is the key problem of all of the big data science today. How do we visualize maximum number of dimensions of this data space that we can? And this is where virtual reality will come in. Because you really never really understand anything unless you can visualize it in some way. Even mathematical objects you have to visualize in some way. So this is where I'm heading with this. So question is then, what can you see in your data? Because that's all that you're going to understand and potentially derive any conclusions. Well, here is your basic Excel spreadsheet, and could be many columns in it. And you can do one-dimensional things like histogram or pie chart. You can do two-dimensional histogram like a two-dimensional plot, X versus Y. But what if you have not two, but hundreds or thousands of columns in your spreadsheet? What do you do then? Well, you can apply tools of machine learning to help you find out which are the more important columns than the others. But then again, you have to see what you're doing. So here is just an example. This is typical type of plots you see in scientific journals. And this is real astronomical data on objects called quasars. And really, it's six-dimensional data space, different properties of these objects. So if you want to look at it all in plots like this, X versus Y, you have 15 different plots to look at. And you can see, well, something's going on. But it's really not quite clear what's going on. Well, let me show you what happens when you look at the exact same data, but in virtual reality. You plunge into this data space where you use X, Y, Z positions and colors and shapes and sizes of data points, and you instantly understand that there are three clusters and there are anomalies and outliers. You can query individual data points, find out why are they somewhere where they do not belong, and it's much more intuitive than anything else that we've ever done. And this is very early example. So this is really where virtual reality will come in. But there is something else about it. It's not just that computers are getting more powerful. It's also the way that we interact with computer is different. It all began with room-sized computers and paper tapes and then punch cards and so on. And then we had eventually desktop revolution, and then went into mobile computing. Like every one of you has in your pocket or purse essentially supercomputer by the standards of the Apollo era. And now we're moving into the new paradigm of how do we interact with computers, which is virtual and augmented reality or mixed reality. And today it involves pretty clunky looking headsets like this one, but that's going to change very, very quickly. So it's not enough to have powerful computers. You have to interact with those computers, and you have to interact in a way that makes sense to you. And moreover, everything else we do now pretty much is online. The entertainment, the way we interact with other people. Your phone calls are no longer done through some kind of copper wire analog mechanism, but really everything is digital and over the internet. So we're moving from the old-fashioned things into something that goes even beyond the internet. And this is where virtual reality technology really is going to be transformative. I believe it will be as transformative relative to what we have today to say what web is relative to pre-web days. And that changed the world. Well, the technology has been developing very rapidly. It was driven largely by the video games industry, but no longer. Now there are many, many uses of virtual reality and augmented reality technologies, and it's really not just the video games. As Dave mentioned, I've been involved in this for about 10 years, and since the very first time I started it, I realized that this was technology that will change the world because it so clicks with human perception and understanding. Well, let me just give you a few examples. Well, this is what industrial design is going to be like, that engineers can actually see 3D models of things that they're making, whether it's like turbines or jet engines. In fact, some of my colleagues at JPL are designing new spacecraft that will send to outer solar system in augmented and virtual reality. And this is a way more powerful than your old CAD CAM, never mind the old blueprints. There is also great new usage in the education and medicine that you can actually see things that you'd never be able to see in real life, and you can look around, and this goes way beyond traditional, say, x-ray pictures or even MRI diagrams, and this will really help both train the doctors and also give them new tools to be able to examine the human body and do something. But also on a social scale. So here is an old lady. Her name is Fran, and she has Parkinson's. And for the past 10 years at least, Fran's been using her alter ego in virtual reality world. And on the lower row, that's what Fran looks like in virtual reality, like she was when she was 20 years old. Anyway, so in that virtual reality, Fran can really barely walk in real life, can go dancing, can go surfing, can have a great fun with her friends, and doesn't matter where the friends are. So she is no longer confined to a single room and a wheelchair. And amazingly enough, when she tries to move as her avatar moves in virtual reality, her physical state improved, and she actually was able to walk. So seniors, especially those who are disabled, can really benefit from this. Something similar here is that the Army is using virtual reality to treat soldiers suffering from post-traumatic syndrome, that they can relive situations that affected them in real life and get to cope with it and understand better. And this virtual reality therapy now is being widely used by the U.S. military. So these are just some of the examples of how this is penetrating essentially every aspect of our activities in the modern world, and science just as well. So my colleagues at JPL created Virtual Mars. They used imagery from the Curiosity rover on Mars and orbiting spacecraft on Mars to recreate three-dimensional terrain on Mars. You know, when geologists study things on planet Earth, they want to go out there in the field and get a sense of what's where and, where the layers are, which rocks are what. Well, they can't do this on Mars directly, but if you can reproduce this, then yeah, You put the headset on, and you're standing on Mars next to Curiosity rover. And you have perspective. You can walk around a little bit. You can see things from different angles. And you can interact with your colleagues who can be somewhere else entirely. So they've done an experiment. The people who drive Curiosity rover, by which they, I mean, they figure out where they want to go next, they program it and let it do, because there's time delay. So they divided them in two groups. One group did a traditional approach. They look at panoramic photographs and decide what's what. And the other group was doing it in virtual reality. And they gave them tests to estimate distances and positions of a whole bunch of rocks. Well, people doing it in virtual reality were four times more accurate than those doing it in traditional way, even though that's what they've been trained to do forever. So for the last couple of years, Mars rover is being driven in virtual reality. I bet you didn't know that. Okay, so why are we getting into virtual reality? Well, here is a whole bunch of reasons. It's been able to see in many dimensions. It is technology that is really going to be the next way in which we interact with information and computers, and each other for that matter. It's much more natural and intuitive than anything on a flat screen. And this is the best part, from my viewpoint. It leveraged multi-zillion dollar investment by the games industry. Zillions units of these, right? So it comes to us for free. These devices are just a miracle devices. They would even give them away for free because they want to sell more games. Games make way more money than movies. And in terms of the data visualization, virtual reality solved problems that plagued traditional ways of visualizing data for a long time. In case of 3D, it's perspective and parallax and so on. And there are studies that demonstrate that this is clearly the case, like the one I told you about on Mars. It's also a natural way for people to collaborate. And we're optimized by nature to live in a 3D space and interact with other people and interact with objects and interact with everything in a 3D space. And so this basically, that gives you a pretty good replica of what it's like to be in some 3D space. And it's also providing a more intuitive understanding of the scene, like in the first video that I've shown you. And you can see things that you can never, ever see in any two-dimensional plot, because in projection, all that structure smooshes, and you don't see things that are hidden behind other things. So this is why it can really change the way any data are analyzed, whether it's astrophysics, or finance, or medicine, or anything else. So this is the origin of the company I mentioned called Virtualytics for virtual analytics. And it's a startup based on, 10 years of research and work at Caltech and JPL. And it really deploys these things in a practical fashion. So here I have a video that was introduction to Virtualytics.
We all have data, lots of data. It's complex, multidimensional, and can reveal insights and trends to help make smarter decisions and more accurate predictions. But how to find that invaluable information when we can only inspect a few dimensions at a time? Step inside your data and experience it in new ways with a powerful virtual reality tool. The VR environment is well suited for human perception, intuition, and pattern recognition that can lead to insights otherwise impossible to gain. Explore and investigate your data in up to 10 dimensions. Visualize overarching trends and outliers. Inspect data specifics. Allow machine learning to define optimal visualizations. Collaborate in a shared virtual office, a natural environment enabling teams to interact with data and one another in a shared virtual space. Leveraging a decade of research at Caltech and NASA JPL is Virtualytics, the powerful cutting-edge data analytics tool and virtual office of the future. Virtualytics, immerse yourself in your data.
So the company's been doing pretty well, I would say. We have several tens of Fortune 500 companies among our customers, and I cannot tell you which ones, because especially our finance customers don't want their competitors to know that they're using our software. It gives them competitive advantage. And also, we've done work with the Department of Defense and talking to more government agencies, because everybody needs to understand the data, and sometimes it's really life or death decision that they have to make. So this is just demonstrated indeed. This is not just some scientist's dream. This is reality, and I think in future, anybody who has more than two columns in their spreadsheet will need two like this. Now, the old days are over. So let me just show you some snapshots. In this environment, we have users, data analysts, whoever, interact directly with the data and also with machine learning that's bundled to it. And it's a more natural way to deal with machine learning than any traditional flat screen or command line application. And we can visualize all kinds of different data, networks as well. It's much easier to understand complex networks, whether it's between people or organizations and so on, if they're not projected onto a flat screen, because suddenly you see things that are just hidden otherwise. You can overlay things on overlay data on geographical information and so on. And as I mentioned, this is also a natural collaborative platform so that you can have users who could be at different ends of the world, say New York, Tokyo, London, Singapore, interact in the same shared virtual space, just like if they're in the same conference room, and interact with the data as well as with each other and with tools that help them discover things. And it's written in a way that can be used both by data expert analysts as well as managers who otherwise would never be able to run any kind of data science technique. Something else that we're doing that I'd like to mention is that we're now building virtual reality teaching labs. And the purpose of this is, well, manifold. First of all, students can then do this at 2 a.m. in their dorm room, which is exactly what Caltech students like to do. But more importantly, you can do things in virtual reality in kind of pseudo hands-on way that's impossible to do in real life. You can get smaller than molecules, enter the molecules, it can be bigger than galaxies. You can build a virtual nuclear reactor, and if it melts down, nobody gets hurt. And if your chemistry experiment explodes, same thing. But also, I think this will be really one of the missing links for the online education. You probably all know about MOOCs, the online classes that everybody can reach. So essentially, we discovered a way to scale up education in terms of the content delivery. Well, what's missing from that is interaction, student to student, student to professor, and social media can help with that. But the other thing that's missing was labs. And in this way, you can make also teaching labs scalable, so anybody in the world can participate in the same way. So let me then turn to artificial intelligence, which is the other transformative technology I think is going on. And in fact, it could be the single most transformative technology ever, maybe aside from invention of fire. And throughout human history, since we got down from the trees, we were inventing technology, and technology was changing us. The reason we have opposable thumbs is so that we can grab sticks or stones and use them as tools or weapons. So today, we can ride in cars much faster than we can run. We can fly in airplanes. We can go under the water, swim faster than fish, and so on and so forth. Well, now we have technology that is actually touching us where it really matters, in our minds. So how many of you have ever spoken with an artificial intelligence? You showed it. Yes. Yeah, some. How many of you have interacted with artificial intelligence in any way? Well, guess what? All of you have. Because every time you use Google or other search engine, you're talking to machine intelligence. And Siri, Cortana, or Alexa are artificial intelligence. By the way, they don't live in your phone. They live in the cloud. And so this is already a start. If you bought plane ticket online, you dealt with machine intelligence, and so on and so forth. So this is technology that's already here with us, and it's getting better and better, and it's helping us. So, for example, nobody remembers anything anymore because you can always look it up on Google, right? Here is an excellent example of what I'm trying to say. Well, before 1998, people saying, oh, machine will never be able to beat humans at chess. Well, then Garry Kasparov found otherwise. And ever since 1998, computers have been world chess champions. Now, in 2016, the game of Go, which supposedly is much more difficult and intuitive than chess, they had machine intelligence actually beat the human champion, which was a shock in Asia where they played this game. And then in 2017, they had another machine. They just showed it rules of the game without training it on anything. And machine invented strategies and won over the previous machine world champion. And has done that by inventing strategies that humans haven't for the last 2,000 years. So it's not that we want machine intelligence to replace us or be just like us. We want it to think different in the ways that we do not and cannot. And that's how it can really expand our abilities of cognition. And by the way, the same machine just learned chess and beat the previous chess world champion in a few hours. So. Well, we've been warned about this, but we really have created an alien intelligence on planet Earth. People search for aliens in space, but here we have a non-human intelligent intelligence, and it's not going away like any other technology. And so the key question is, how do we interact with it in an optimal way? And then grow it in a way that's really complementary to our abilities, become symbiotic with what we do. Well, for a long time, Hollywood was warning us about this. And the connoisseurs of this genre know that the one in the red dress is the most dangerous of all of them. But Skynet is probably not going to happen, and the robot Terminators will not happen. What I think really will happen is we will develop symbiotic relationship with machine intelligence. So we do this already. We've been using machine learning in scientific data analysis since early 1990s. And ever since then, we've been using it more and more for all kinds of things, to monitor quality of data, to help us discover new relationships, to do routine tasks that human can do, like separating different classes of objects and so on. And this is really what first uses of machine intelligence will be, that what we may call routine intelligence can be outsourced to machines because they'll do it better. They do it perfectly, at least the way they're trained correctly. And so, for example, self-driving cars, many people expect that those will be getting fairly common within a decade or so. And most of the time when you're driving a car, you're using intelligence, it's kind of pretty routine. And if all cars on the road are smart, then there'll be many fewer accidents, more lives will be saved. So we do use it in science for all manner of things, and we always try to find more things, pushing further developments. And overall, I think we are very much on the path of the developing human-computer collaborative discovery. So we will be doing science inside these virtual spaces, already doing it. But it also happens to be really the most intuitive technological platform we have so far for humans to interact with everything, including machine intelligence, and maybe really robots, which are pixel robots, not physical robots. But just like you talk to disembodied voice on your phone, Siri, find me the nearest restaurant, well, you prefer probably if there was a human-like manifestation They can ask the same thing. So I would say that combination of artificial intelligence and virtual reality is leading to what you may call the cognition technology, technology that enables us to understand and know a lot more than we have up until now. So with that, I'll end. I think these are the two technologies that are already changing our world and will continue to do so. Artificial intelligence to help us find knowledge in masses of data and understand things that we couldn't, and virtual reality, which will help us understand that and be also a much more effective way of communicating with each other and any knowledge we have. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And I'll be happy to answer some questions.
We do have a few questions, and we will try to get through them, although I don't know if time will allow for all of them. But with a little help down here at the table, while we try to sort through ones that might be of more significance to the audience, okay? First question, how does the U.S. stand versus other countries like China in developing these technologies?
An excellent question. In fact, China has been investing enormously in development of artificial intelligence, I would say more than U.S. Our government sometimes does the right things and sometimes not. And I would say Chinese investment in science and technology and education just dwarfs the United States. Even though, you know, a lot of scientists worldwide don't think in terms of politics and collaborate as best as they can, but this is really transformative technology and will also provide power. In fact, Comrade Putin said that whoever rules artificial intelligence will rule the world. You know what he wants. So I don't think that will happen, but yes, we have at least not catching up to do, but some serious running to do.
That works into another question, again, on use of this technology. How committed medical world very much behind this movement? In other words, how far behind are we behind the movement? You already touched on it, but do you have any further comment?
Yes, and the problems there are not technological, but really sociological. This is always the case with the uptake of new technology. A late great computer scientist, Jim Gray, told me once, may all of your problems be technological. The problem is that medical community does not have data culture and computing culture built in, not yet anyway. And they don't even understand what term metadata means. So they're not ready from expertise viewpoint. To make life a little worse, there is the red tape that any data that involve humans. And that is completely unnecessary difficulty. But there are a lot of outfits that are trying, and you may know that Jeff Bezos and forget who else, and Jamie Dimon, they're trying to start a whole new approach to healthcare that will be heavily technological, and that may be the way to go. So I think the potential is phenomenal, but that community has a lot changing to do.
Next question. What are the military applications? Can it help with coordination and sharing information? That's my question, by the way.
Well, I can't tell you what we are doing for the military, but yeah, it's been able to find things that you couldn't in using traditional approach and make connections that you won't be able to do, at least not as fast, using traditional approach.
How many students at Caltech are studying ways to employ virtual reality and technology, and what specifically, if you could comment on that?
I don't know. It's a relatively new thing. There may be half dozen students who are working with us directly on this. There were another 10 maybe in the past. But I know that some other professors are also getting into it. But it's not yet prevalent. Caltech, even though it's a very innovative institution, sometimes can be also very traditional. And when I first started this and started proselytizing it, all my colleagues thought I went nuts. But now things are different. And I expect that this will be a much more active field in the years to come.
I was trying to find a student question, but I don't have it. That's all right. How big is the 24421 asteroid?
Oh, it's probably about the size of Naples, Florida. So I know it's a great real estate. The views are fantastic, but the flights there be expensive, and you have to bring your own oxygen.
Very good, very good. Let's see. I'm to the end here, I think. Yes, I am. Have you observed in your work evidence of intelligent design of the universe?
No.
That's good. That's good. Yes, no.
But it's a serious question, actually, and it's getting some revival. I mean, search for extraterrestrial intelligence began in 1950s using radio, which I always thought was plain silly. Like, why would an advanced civilization use mid-20th century planetary technology? But now a number of scientists, including myself, are actually trying to start thinking out of the box. And can we see things out there that stand out in some quantifiable way and yet turn out not to be natural phenomena? So who knows?
With that question, we'll conclude the meeting, but our speaker has offered to stick around a little longer, has a little extra time. If any of you want to come and ask any specific questions that he might have a good answer for. So, again, thank you, George, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.